and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. The Israeli Prime Minister's third visit to Washington this year has been billed as a kind of victory lap for both Trump and Netanyahu. Both leaders are discussing the forcible displacement of the Palestinians and the next steps against Iran. Trump is very much on board with Israel's vision for the Middle East. Crosstalking BB in Washington, I'm joined by my guest, Michael Maloof in Reston. He is a former Pentagon senior security policy analyst. In Beirut, we have Joe Macaron. He is a political analyst. And in New Delhi, we cross the Kaolo Bachacharji. He is a journalist and author. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Michael, let me go to you first here. As I said in my introduction, this is kind of being billed as a victory lap. The United States and Israel claim to be the victors in the so-called 12-day war. There's a lot of people that contest that. We can contest it on this program if you wish. But it's also being billed as some kind of diplomatic negotiation roundtable. It seems anything but that. It seems like the next stage is against the Palestinians, and the next stage, the next part, the next step in the war against Iran. Hardly negotiations for peace. Go ahead, Michael.
Yeah, I think that you're absolutely right. I think that this is really them getting together, Netanyahu and Trump, to plan the next steps. The losers will, in all of this, will be the Palestinians. And I think Netanyahu will need to actually encourage and maybe force Trump to go along with the next stage of trying for regime change in Tehran. That is his goal. And if he doesn't achieve that, his government will fall, thanks to Ben-Gvir and Smotrich, who are insisting upon it. So I think Trump will go along, and he's going to be forced to. He's paid by his donors, who are very pro-Israeli. They are insistent upon this, not to mention the Israeli lobby. So he's. Even though he appears to be a strong guy, he's not. He does have his weaknesses, and that is he does bow to his contributors, and he will bow basically to the last person he spoke to, frankly.
Yeah, but Michael, you know, if I can stay with you, what's really interesting about that, because we talked before about, is he a strong leader or not a strong leader? I think he tends to be a very weak leader, but he's being surrounded by people telling him, we're winning, you're winning, okay? Which there's ample evidence to the contrary. We're in the middle of something. It's very, very dangerous for all involved. But if you only hear one message, then why wouldn't he go along with it, Michael?
Well, he likes the adoration. He insists upon it. That is just his style. But the fact that he is the leader of the most powerful country in the world, he can come on bombastically, and then in terms of trying to come to a deal of some kind, he'll settle for something in between. But but every time he does that, the world listens. That allows him to take charge, to leverage everybody, and to control events rather than have events control him. And that's what he's attempting to do. But I think he's losing that control because of the people he has around him, namely the neocons and the pro-Israeli types and the defense industry lobbyists. Because that's what they want. They want war, and he is catering to that. And you'll notice that the defense budget is over $1 trillion this year. That's unbelievable.
Yeah, but he'll do it. But he'll do it because he thinks he's winning, which he's not. Joe, let me go to you. I mean, also what was in the news before the Israeli prime minister arrived was a so-called ceasefire in Gaza, as if it's two armies fighting each other. It is just a slaughter of a civilian population. But it's being all dressed up as negotiations and a ceasefire. Trump is behind it. Well, I don't know. The way I look at it is that the ceasefire is just, this is just political theater, because what we see before our eyes are basically three options for the people of Gaza: starve to death, get killed trying to feed yourself, and being forced to leave. How is that a ceasefire? But that's how the media is presenting it. What it looks like to me is a forced deportation of the Palestinian people, and Trump will get on board with that. Go ahead, Joe.
I mean, in theory, at least, there are ceasefire talks between Hamas and Israel through the Qatari and the Egyptian negotiator. But definitely, it's a very complicated situation. As you mentioned, it's a one-way war. I don't think Netanyahu at this point is ready for a ceasefire. It's very complicated for his for the stability of his government, more or less. They are happy to keep the status quo, more or less, until they have like a good outcome they want. The Israeli army is very frustrated. They want to finish this war. They don't see a political outcome beyond a ceasefire. And then you have Trump, who thinks about normalization, he wants to move forward, but he's not exerting enough pressure on Netanyahu to move forward. We saw it in the conference they had when Trump was asked about the two-state solution. He said, "Well, ask Netanyahu." He is basically withdrawn himself. He just wants a ceasefire to finish the war, no matter what the outcome is. He's not thinking long term. That you have to think about the Saudis and the Egyptians, how they're going to move forward without a solution beyond the ceasefire. There's no real thinking what's the day after the ceasefire, who's going to have the control, what will happen to the Palestinians. He mentioned Netanyahu that you're going to give them the free will basically to leave. It's like they have an option basically. So they are, I think Trump is going into the technicalities of the ceasefire, but it's not thinking long term. How to approach, how to relate it
with Joe, Iran. Why should we have any faith when it comes to Trump and a ceasefire? He allowed his own ceasefire to be destroyed. He allowed the Israelis to break that ceasefire. So, I mean, where's the faith in this here? I mean, where this is just a repeat of what we saw in January. And plus, everyone's talking about, it's not a secret, this kind of side agreement, sign letter that Israel can do whatever it wants, however it interprets a ceasefire. So, I mean, this is not a negotiation about a ceasefire. This is political theater.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we saw it in Lebanon. There was an agreement between the U.S. and Israel that allowed them to continue. Even in Iran now, Netanyahu is asking also some... but the problem is we don't have a balance of power. Israeli have this aerial power. The only way to restrain them is through the American pressure. This is the reality now. We like it or not. Mm-hmm. But the Iranians can't do the job. Nobody else can do it. So now Trump is basically smitten, I can't find the better word, by Netanyahu. He basically gave them Nobel Peace Prize.
Well, that's why I'm calling this program the Trump BB tag team, because that's exactly what it is. That's the name of the... Let me go to our third guest in New Delhi. Kaolo, well, how does the Global South watching all of this here? I mean, we had two nuclear powers, one declared, one undeclared, attack a non-nuclear power country, Iran. We have an ongoing genocide. What is there to negotiate about? It's basically, this is a war agenda. This has nothing to do with about getting a peace. It's not about negotiation. It's managing a war against one country and a group of defenseless people. Go ahead in New Delhi.
Well, thank you so much for inviting to your show. Yes, the Global South is really looking at the developments in Middle East, that's West Asia for us, as if it's part of a nightmare scenario. Because what we have in the Gulf, that is in the Persian Gulf region, from the Indian point of view, around 10 million expat workers. And any conflict that breaks out in that region is a nightmare scenario for India specifically. Because we have 10 million workers, 10 million Indian citizens living and working in countries like Saudi Arabia, Dubai, Qatar, Bahrain, and Oman. And a conflict involving Iran and the United States in the Gulf is really a very bad scenario from any point of view that you look at when you take the Indian situation. Number one is the Indian citizens who would get caught in such a conflict scenario. And secondly, India's own energy security would be jeopardized. And if the Strait of Hormuz is shut by a conflict, you know, because of a conflict by either of the, you know, parties, then you can imagine the chaos that will hit the energy market of India and the stock markets of India, and you can imagine the rest of the consequences that will flow for India. So obviously, I mean, from the Indian point of view, I would say that's number one, that it's not a conflict to any advantage when it comes to India. And secondly, when you talk about the global South, most of the global South has similar interests, because when you travel to Saudi Arabia, you find citizens of so many other countries, you know, yep. from Bangladesh to Thailand, to Philippines, Pakistan, and so many other nationalities work in the Gulf. And we already saw in the recent conflict how people from Philippines and Thailand had to be evacuated. So, you know, so from our point of view, from the Global South's point of view, it's a humanitarian tragedy that could unfold.
Carlo, before we go to the break here, but what about the international law? I mean, countries like India, Russia, China are always scolded for not following international law. But then we have countries like Israel, the United States, that don't mention international law at all. I mean, this is destroying the international system.
Well, we know what the current leadership of the United States believes in, and Prime Minister Netanyahu has often talked about peace through strength. Now, if that is a principle in international affairs, then you can imagine it also means peace through destruction.
Yes.
So, you know, it's basically a might is right approach.
Yep. There
and
we go.
We have always believed and we have always studied international on a situation, international you know, arena, to be in a state of nature of eternal warfare. But what we are witnessing today is really a scene of eternal anarchy being you know, engineered, especially by the most powerful.
I agree with you completely. Gentlemen, I have to go to a hard break here, and after that hard break, we'll continue our discussion on Bibi's trip to Washington. Stay with RT.
After the end of World War II, Great Britain decided to make up for its losses with the merciless exploitation of its colonies. The plundering of the occupied territories hit Malaya, devastated as a result of decades-long fighting, extremely hard. Tension grew, and in 1948, the colonial administration was forced to declare a state of emergency. In response, patriots united into the Malayan People's Liberation Army and began a guerrilla war. London decided to suppress resistance. Torture and mass deportations, executions of civilians and spraying of chemicals, scalping and cutting off heads. These were the barbaric methods the British used trying to keep Malaya within their empire. The massacre in the village of Batang Kali, committed by the Scots Guards against the unarmed peasants, caused a particular stir. The entire male population became victims. Trying to suppress the guerrilla movement, the occupiers relocated 500,000 people to concentration camps. The ferocious cruelty bore its fruit. The patriots were scattered. However, the British experienced the strength of the Malay resistance to the full extent. The British Army losses in Malaya were the largest since the end of World War II. In 1957, the British Empire was forced to recognize Malayan independence. The resilience of the Malay people put an end to the history of British colonialism in Southeast Asia.
Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter LaBelle. To remind you, we're discussing Bibi in Washington. All right, let's go back to Michael. Michael, one of the most bizarre things I've ever seen in my life in working in media, I see a lot of bizarre things, okay? So, you know, I don't want this to seem exaggerated. But Bibi Netanyahu presented a letter nominating Donald Trump for the Nobel Peace Prize as they're both strategizing about maybe Trump isn't aware of it, you know, because he has what he calls the in boom out. He thinks that's not a war-like activity. It is. It's unprovoked and it's illegal. But, you know, is this his goal? Is to get the Nobel Peace Prize? And is Netanyahu his guide to get it? I mean, this is beyond bizarre, Michael.
Well, it is something that he has expressed numerous times that maybe I should get the Nobel Peace Prize. I brought India, Pakistan together. He mentions Rwanda, and he's talked about Sudan. What's ironic, totally ironic, is the fact that you have the head of the genocide in Palestine offering a letter of a nomination of a Nobel Peace Prize for Trump. And it just sours, especially when the guy has an indictment under the ICC, the International Court of Justice, and it's ironic. But to get back to one other thing that you mentioned, in terms of Trump always wanting to be right and have people surrounding him to always give him accolades, there was one significant absence at the dinner table last night between Trump and Netanyahu, because he had a live press conference. He had the principals there. He had the CIA director, the defense director, secretary, et cetera. But the absent, the one who was absent, was Tulsi Gabbard.
Yeah.
She was the one who said that Iran had the capability but did not have a nuclear weapons program. And he didn't like that. He disagreed. And this is why I mentioned earlier that he speaks to the last, he reacts to the last person he spoke to. He was going along with that until, and his entire intelligence community, until Bibi presented him with something that none of us are aware of that made him change his mind. Now, what was it? We don't know, that caused him then to change his mind and go ahead and bomb, do his bombing run. So there's the man is lost. I think he's lost. He's surrounded by people who are trying to guide him into war on the one hand, but on the other hand, he doesn't have a clear direction. He claims he wants peace, but he also has to cozy up to the likes of Netanyahu because of his contributors, as I said.
Well, Joe, I mean, one of the things, the whole Trump foreign policy, for me, on the one hand, I can understand it. He thinks it through President McKinley, great power politics, as if the 20th century never happened with international law, international humanitarian law. I kind of get that, okay? But, you know, when it comes to American interests, you would think he would have a strategy. Now, it could be a bad strategy, a poor strategy, but a strategy nonetheless. I don't even see the strategy. For example, given all of the changes we've seen over the last 2 years in the greater Middle East, West Asia, as other people call it, how is this making Israel and the United States safer internationally?
You are right. There's no coherent strategy. It's a very individualistic, instinctive foreign policy. Based on his character, we see in a few weeks he did a deal with the Houthis. He got a deal with Hamas to get the American hostages, and then suddenly he went and bombed Iran. He felt for a while he was upset from Netanyahu because he came behind his back to talk to his White House National Security, who was moved out. So he reacted this way, and then he basically mended his relation with Netanyahu, and then he shifted again. So it's not about ego, it's not about how his gut is in a moment, but we don't see, yes, a coherent, but what makes sense is the U.S. should have its own separate foreign policy independent of Israel. This is how the administration over either you have to basically control Israel or basically go with it in the war, or try to basically have a separate, as he did when he did the deal with the Houthis. He said, I only care about American interests, let Israeli deal with that. But now he shifted again. I think American and Israeli interests, even under Trump, are not aligned. Trump doesn't want to go as far as Netanyahu, but he still not have a alternative. He's not putting forward a clear vision. This is what we want. We want a deal on the nuclear. We want to do this or this with the Saudis, do the normalization. There's no systematic. He's just jumping up and down without a clear vision. And this is not helping, I think, not even to secure Israel and not even to secure American interests in the long term.
Yeah, let's go back to our guest in New Delhi. Continuing with international law, what is the value of international law right now when you have unprovoked attacks? Particularly since the United States and Iran were involved in negotiations. I mean, it was well known. And I actually, maybe foolishly in retrospect, was hoping something might come of them. Okay. And then in the middle of negotiations, Israel starts a war. The United States follows up. I mean, what's the point of negotiating? What is the point of negotiating with the United States? Again, from a global South perspective, I mean, the international system, you're just prey if you're not strong. And if you're not strong, you want to have a deterrence, like a nuclear weapon. And then everybody wants a nuclear weapon. I mean, that's a nightmare scenario for the world. Go ahead in New Delhi.
Well, you have asked really a very important question, because even though it's a very scary weapon, nuclear technology is really an ancient technology for the 21st century. It's a technology from early 20th century, and the knowledge or of the quantum physics and et cetera, these are all very academic stuff that developed in the late 19th century. So, nuclear science or nuclear weapons are scary, but, you know, anybody can really develop them, because today, all over the world, we have such a large number of nuclear scientists, students and academicians, that you really can't destroy nuclear weapons by... nuclear weapons facilities.
Well, if I could interrupt, I mean, I don't think the United States would have attacked Iran if it had had nuclear weapons.
Yeah, but then Iran's knowledge of nuclear technology will remain. And that is impossible to erase through these sort of bombing raids. You know, what's foolhardy in this entire campaign is that nuclear weapons or nuclear, you know, technology of nuclear energy, or, you know, that whole knowledge system doesn't really reside in those huge domes and nuclear reactors. They reside in the minds of nuclear scientists.
Right.
And they remain, and because Iran has a very large, you know, body of nuclear scientists and nuclear academics and scholars and students who will develop that capability whenever they can fund it next time. So the question that you asked about international law today has become like that elephant in front of those five blind men.
Yeah.
You know, everybody defines international law in his or her own to his or her own advantage. I mean, there is nothing uniform or nothing universal about international law in the 21st century that we are witnessing. Even academically speaking, there is no agreement about what is really international law. When it comes to, say, the South China Sea, international law takes one shape. It talks about freedom of navigation. But when it comes to Gaza, you know, international law forgets the humanitarian chapters of international law. And so therefore, I think, you know, we are living in a very dangerous time in our history, where the whole architecture of international law is being done away with.
Okay, well, Michael, before the program started, we were talking about Trump's foreign policy and MAGA. Let's talk a little bit more about that, because as you were telling me, MAGA is pretty much on board with Trump's domestic agenda, but not with its foreign policy. If Trump attacks Iran again or signs off on Israel's maniacal plans for the Palestinians, is his popularity in MAGA going to take a hit?
I think it will. People are sick and tired of 25 years of endless war, and we've seen that. We see it building, and therein lies the problem within his own camp. The people really voted for Trump to take care of the domestic problems, not to go out. Yeah, stop wars, but don't start new ones. But that's precisely what he's doing. If he continues along the trek of following Netanyahu, Trump is really Netanyahu's puppet. That's what he's turned into. And we're seeing this because he's doing everything Netanyahu wants him to do. Eventually, he gets around to it, to doing what Netanyahu wants. And the American people are sick and tired of it, at least the fervent MAGA supporters who voted him into office. And that's why you hear him talking on the one hand, saying, I want peace, but then he goes ahead and does just the opposite. He's a very mercurial guy. Not only an extreme pragmatist, but he also likes to keep everybody off guard. And by doing that, it keeps the attention of the world on him.
Yeah, but it doesn't engender trust. That's one of the problems.
No, it doesn't.
We got 1 minute. Let Joe. I have a really bad feeling that it's possible, maybe not likely, but it's possible that by the time Netanyahu leaves Washington, he'll have convinced Trump that Israel can annex the West Bank.
Already has.
I mean, there's a risk because if he wants to please the Israeli radicals, that okay, we have a ceasefire in Gaza, and they are more emotionally attached to the West Bank. So yes, it might come next. He wants to please Trump. He wants to give him something. So Trump asking for a ceasefire. So he might come with any ceasefire that will allow him to continue targeting Hamas if they move. And then they start to do maybe settlement activities or other stuff in the West Bank. It's open. You don't have a clear Arab position. You don't see Arab or Saudi drawing the red line and say, okay, this is where we pull. They are playing along because they want Iran weaker at this point. So, yeah, he thinks he has a blank check in return for appeasing Trump.
Well, then gentlemen, we've run out of time. Everything is to be determined, one would say. That's all the time. Fascinating discussion. I want to thank my guests in Rest in Beirut and in New Delhi. And, of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, crosstalk rules.